And I'm Trevor, and welcome to Catching Up on Cinema. If you aren't familiar with the program, Catching Up on Cinema is a film analysis podcast wherein we introduce each other to films, expand our cinematic horizons, and, in essence, catch up on our cinema. So, it is the month of December 2023. Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays, by the way. Mm-hmm. We haven't really had a theme this month on the program, but essentially what we've been doing from week to week is I gave Kyle about 8 different movies that I was somewhat interested in covering this month, and he did me the great service of making the decisions for me, of weeding out those 8 picks and winnowing it down to just 4 for us to cover this month. Now, this has resulted in some, I guess what you'd call a mixed bag of quality throughout the month. Yeah. So, Kyle, would you care to introduce the film that we're going to be talking about today and how you felt about it?
Yeah. Today we did Enemy Mine from 1985, directed by Wolfgang Petersen, starring Dennis Quaid, Lou Gossett Jr., and then Brian James comes in at the end, from what I could tell. Yeah, so an American space dude gets stranded on a planet with an alien that speaks by gurgling his spit. And he can also give birth. All these aliens have male and female anatomy, and he gives birth, and Dennis Quaid grows a beard and long hair. Yeah, dude, this is a movie about, you know, two people that really can't communicate, or two beings that can't really communicate, learning to appreciate each other and live in harmony. But yeah, dude.
So, spoilers, folks. Kyle, not a big fan of this film. This was a first-time watch for him. So, a catching up on cinema, if you will, for Kyle. Not true for myself. I had seen this film several times in my youth, back in the day when I was young. I think this was one that was just like on cable or something. And are you that, or maybe it was during that golden era where my household, my parents' house, they had access to the Encore network. And I made liberal use of that. We didn't have that all the time when I was growing up, but we did have it for a spell. And I watched that channel quite a lot, and that man with the very weird hand gestures that he'd make introducing each film. He would do this thing where I'd call it the power triangle, where he'd like cup his hands over his crotch and like form this weird triangular shape. And then he'd like sweep his hand out to the side because you could tell he was just one of those people who didn't know what to do with his hands when he was talking. Weird, quirky shit that, you know, my dad's genes probably baked it into me that I have to laser in and focus on those things. It's like, what the fuck is up with that guy? Like, it's a sign of weakness. Anyway, as I said, I've seen this film several times. I like it. I find it charming. Obviously, it doesn't work for everybody. Kyle, most important of all. But yeah, just to give a little bit of a background on this film, what it is and how we got it. As Kyle had said, this is directed by Wolfgang Petersen, who is a German filmmaker who had a hell of a run, but he's kind of tapped out, as far as I understand. I don't think he's working anymore in the film industry.
He's dead.
Oh, he is. Okay. Yeah. I wasn't aware of that.
You're right. He's not working in the film industry anymore, Trevor. You were right about that.
He tapped out from this mortal coil. He tapped out to life.
He shed his mortal skin, and he is now beyond.
He's riding the great luck dragon in the sky.
What's Wolfgang been working on lately? Not a lot.
That mystery is now solved. As far as I know, his last film was in 2016. But just to like point out some of his major hits, one of which I'm actually going to rope Kyle into saying a little something about, because he was the one who introduced it to me. An early hit of his, kind of the one that put him on the international map as a filmmaker, was Das Boot from 1981. Now, Kyle, how did you come across Das Boot, and what are your feelings on it?
I don't know how I came across it. I think I just saw it one day, and I'm like, hey, I'm going to watch that. It's got pretty good reviews, and it's the same director as Air Force One. I'm like, okay, And I love it. It's one of my favorite war movies. I'd say I put it right below Saving Private Ryan as probably one of the best, and the best seafaring war movie I've seen as well.
Yeah, I would say it's the best submarine war film I've ever seen. I've seen a handful of them, like, say, Crimson Tide and U-571 and T-19, The Widowmaker. Yeah.
I always think, because they capture that guy in U-571, and they're like, what's that noise? What's that tapping noise? And he's tapping in Morse code, I am U-571, destroy me. And I always thought that was a cool thing. But every time I see that cover of the film.
Yeah, it's not a bad film. Is it Bill Paxton who's in the opening act of that one, or is it some other fella who I slot into that similar category?
I do believe like John Bon Jovi, David Keith, and I think
David Keith is who I was thinking of. I think
Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah, he's in like the opening before they have to get on the sub.
Oh, Bill Paxton's in there too. Oh, Harvey Keitel, the bad guy from Blade 2, the old dude, the old gross dude.
Oh yeah, I forget his name, but he's got a
Thomas tricky one. Kretschmann, I think.
Sure. Yeah. Anyway, Das Boot is an exceptional war film and submarine film. Everything about it, actually, as a film production, is very impressive. Like, it looks great, the editing is great, the soundtrack, I think, even though it's like anachronistic, like it has like a synth quality to it that doesn't fit with the 1940s time period. I think it's great. The theme music for that movie is awesome, such that I actually bought the vinyl of it for my buddy Orion. You've met him. But yeah, Das Boot is a classic, certified classic, a very well-respected film. Involved quite a lot of special effects work, which is kind of a common thing in Wolfgang Peterson's filmography. He does a lot of grand spectacle films. There's oftentimes like an element of whimsy to his films I've noticed that isn't so much apparent in Das Boot, but a lot of his other movies kind of have that quality to them. But Neverending Story, I did mention Luck Dragon in the Sky. Neverending Story was a big international hit. It was a staple of a lot of households when I was growing up. I don't know about you, Kyle. Did like friends of yours have that tape in their houses, or did you?
We did. We watched the hell out of that movie.
A Neverending Story. That hair. Folks, if you haven't seen, was it Lamal? If you haven't seen that hairdo from back in the day, check it out. Makes Tina Turner look modest.
It makes Rufio look modest from Hook.
Yeah, by comparison. Neverending Story. I never owned it growing up. I've only seen it like frontwards and backwards. Like I've only seen it like once or twice through, but I've seen chunks of it countless times because it was always on at like friends' houses and stuff. I did that one, and then that was the film that directly preceded Enemy Mine. And then Kyle did mention Air Force One. That came out in 97. That was a huge hit, grand spectacle action thriller film featuring Harrison Ford. At the time, I think he was like the highest paid actor in Hollywood. Big fucking deal movie. Outbreak, less so, based on a Michael Crichton novel, I believe. Very goofy movie in a lot of ways, but it was like a highly promoted film. Like it was one of those things that you would absorb it through cultural osmosis. Like it's like, oh, it's that little monkey movie with the virus or whatever. It's like, you know, it was that movie. Perfect Storm, Kyle. You I thought at one point wanted to do an episode on that one, right?
Yeah, I love that movie. I'm actually kicking around an idea, Mid-Atlantic Accent Month, and that's on there.
I kind of love that. I don't know how I would make a graphic of that, but I think that's something I'd have to feed into a AI image generator just to see what it comes up with.
Yeah, I've got American Gangster, 13 Days, Black Mass, and then The Perfect Storm on there.
I like it. I'm on board with this. We got to find a time to do that, bud.
But the key thing is that people have to be doing like some kind of Mid-Atlantic Northeastern accent. Like it has to be... Every actor is committed to that.
Let's make it happen. But yeah, Perfect Storm, based on a true story. Mark Wahlberg loves his American tragedy movies for some reason. He loves those roles. Troy, I have mixed feelings about. Kyle just put a fist up. I think he's a fan, right?
Yeah, we watched the hell out of that when we were younger. Rose Byrne, Brad Pitt, Brian Cox doing, I think, Agamemnon, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Pretty great.
He's a motherfucker in that movie.
Yeah.
He's savage.
pissed off Brad Pitt yelling at Hector, Eric Bana. Pretty great.
Hector, yeah, we are not men, we are lions.
I mean, it's probably at this point aughts trash, but I remember watching the hell out of it when we were younger.
Shit, we could do a whole month on Wolfgang Petersen. Like, he's got enough certified bangers in his not so dense filmography. He had a hell of a run as a filmmaker.
He's got the juice, man. He's got the juice.
He got the juice. And Poseidon is one I haven't seen, but I do know it's a remake of the Poseidon Adventure. I believe Kurt Russell's in that one, and we all love Kurt Russell.
We all do. I think that's where he does a very, very convincing drowning death, from what I hear.
I have had that spoiled for myself as well. Yeah, that's not how you want to see Kurt Russell in any movie, but, no. You know, it is what it is. I've seen the original Poseidon Adventure. It's a good one. It's a good environmental, like, disaster thriller. Something that, you know, we've had waves of in U.S. cinema in particular. The 90s in particular was like a big comeback for that. The 70s is kind of where it got its big start. But Poseidon Adventure is a good one. I'd like to see the remake just to see what he did with it, because it checks a lot of his boxes. I mean, for fuck's sake, it's a fucking nautical film. And on top of that, like, it's a disaster film. He does that pretty well. Anyway, the story of how Wolfgang Petersen came to be involved in this film is actually somewhat interesting. And I won't go into exhaustive detail here. But the story goes, a fellow by the name of Richard Longcrane, who, as far as I know, isn't like a particularly noteworthy filmmaker, he was contracted to do this film. And it had a substantial budget at the time, but due to not so great dailies, the producers got squirrely about it, and they were itching to kick him off the project. They weren't happy with this man, is what I'm saying. So Wolfgang Petersen was contacted, probably on the strength of Das Boot and Neverending Story, being as it was a special effects intensive film. And he was reluctant at first, but he came on board and he righted the ship. However, it came at great cost. This was apparently a remarkably expensive film, even though it doesn't always look to be the case. It's like a $40 million film, and it started out as half of that, but the budget essentially doubled because they made the movie twice. Because they got like 5 weeks into shooting it with the original director, they kicked him off, and Wolfgang Petersen wouldn't work on it unless he could remake it from whole cloth. So they basically shot most of the movie, and then they redid it. They went back to formula, to quote Spider-Man. and as far as I understand, that also involved redoing the makeup effects for Lou Gossett Jr. and all the other characters in the movie, going entirely back to the drawing board when it came to the matte paintings and the production design on the whole. They pulled up stakes and they moved the production to a different part of the world. They moved it to Germany on sound stages, where they also shot Das Boot, you know, familiar territory for the filmmaker, essentially. So they made the movie twice, and at great cost, and it didn't make any fucking money. It was a big disaster. So it's, I guess, a learning experience for the studio. Not so much for Wolfgang Petersen. As far as I can tell, he was pretty happy with what he did with it. But it's a curious case of a movie that got made twice, and at very great cost, because like all the major actors and stuff involved also were being paid for the downtime in which the production wasn't running. So this is a case of how not to make a movie, is what I'm saying. Very interesting little case study. Anyway, Kyle already gave the plot summary of this one, already mentioned some of the actors involved. So I figured, being as Kyle really, he made some nasty faces before I started talking about this one. Like, he just, his disdain was readily apparent before we even started talking. Being as Kyle wasn't a fan of this one, I don't want to drag you down and force you to talk with me for 3 hours about this one. So how about we just talk to me this shit and just have a chat, Kyle? So what are some things that you'd like to get off your chest about this movie? Like, what about it hurt you?
Well, I love the space opening. I was super excited. There's an awesome, like, little battle to start this movie out. You get to see the exteriors of this of these spaceships, which I'm like, okay, cool. We got ourselves a space movie. I'm excited. This is going to be fun. And then immediately, we are done with spaceships pretty much for the rest of the film, except for maybe one little five-second shot of another one. I think that I'll talk about the positives about this movie. I think that Lou Gossett Jr. does something with this character. He makes this character a character, for sure. I think that he does a good job with this. But the gurgling of spit language that he speaks it was disgusting. Because it was so gross. So I'm like, I know how he's doing it. It's just... like, it's really disgusting. I don't know why they thought that was a good idea.
I think the idea was to make it as foreign to English-speaking ears as possible. Because there's a lot of choices made with the presentation of the Drac character in the movie that do seem to be deliberately, like, trying to convey something alien and difficult to understand at a glance. Like, even some of, like, his postures, like, the way he sleeps, like, with his ass up in the air, with his face buried in the ground, he looks like a cartoon image of like, an ostrich or something, or, like, a dirty image from a manga or something. but I think the language, I read that it was... I mean, it's all bullshit, obviously, but, like, the sounds apparently were Russian... backwards, like phonetically pronounced backwards, with the noises that Kyle's talking about, the gurgling.
Not if you count the gurgling sound. And I will give a tip to the hat to Mr. DQ. He commits to this performance, and it's corny. Like, he definitely is. He is this character, and I appreciate his the amount of effort he gave to make this a good performance. But this concept, like, this idea for a movie is like a boring thread on Star Trek, which is already pretty boring. But this would be like an hour-long episode where Kirk or Spock is just, like, on a planet with, like, a Ferengi or whatever the fuck. And they have to, like, try to learn how to communicate. I just think you needed some more action-y stuff in this, and it takes so long. Like, just the them getting to know each other, setting up camp, it just takes so long. I think this was just a little too long.
Yeah, at times it does feel draggy, and it's actually kind of a painful case of a movie that kind of needs to be long in order to achieve what they're doing.
Yeah.
But by the time you get to the final reel of it, they really hit the accelerator and try to give you what you were just talking about, the action component of it. But because it comes at such an accelerated pace at the very tail end of the movie, it feels disingenuous. Like, it feels like it shouldn't be here. So it's like I don't know how you would actually balance that. It's kind of an impossible task, because if you really wanted to do everything in a balanced fashion, it would be even longer, and that would probably make it overall just straight up worse. But I think people listening to this will have opinions about you referencing Star Trek, so I feel I ought to get into that. Yeah, you're absolutely right. This has been done as 40-minute Star Trek episodes. Like, I'm not knowledgeable of all of Star Trek, but I do know Kirk versus the Gorn guy. I mean, I have a lot of interest, Kyle, and I don't have enough hours in my life to pull that into me.
Trevor, I'm gonna kind of reference Mark Wahlberg in The Departed. Let's say you know nothing, okay? You know nothing about Star Trek.
At best,
you know nothing.
what I know is a drop in a vast bucket of knowledge, an impossibly vast bucket of knowledge, because that lore shit is expansive.
Yeah, dude, you don't have enough breaths. You couldn't even start now if you wanted to.
know. Even if I tried starting today, I would expire before I could even scratch the surface on that. But
if you're trying to be an Olympic athlete of Star Trek knowledge in your 30s, you're never going to make it. Like, it's not going to happen.
You gotta start early.
You gotta start young, dude. It's a lot of shit.
You don't lace up those gloves by the time you're 5, you're gonna be so behind. But
if you can't speak Klingon by the time you hit middle school, you're never gonna learn it. It's not gonna happen.
These are things that, should I have children, I'll have to sit them down and have a chat with them about. And they'll be like 12 years old, and they'll be like, "Son, I know you're into the Star Trek business, but you're just too damn old. You should have found it earlier. There's people out there, son, that want it more." I'll just say that. They want it more. They have grit that you wasn't raised with. Anyway, just to throw out some fun references here, I have seen at least the fight between Captain Kirk and the Gorn. That would be the lizard fella. It's kind of a little bit of that going on here. I do know there's at least 2 episodes of Next Gen that I have seen. I have watched all of Next Gen, including the movies, which are of varying degrees of quality. There's the one where Geordi is, I think, stranded on a planet with a Romulan, and it's essentially the same scenario, although they do speak a common language because they have the universal translator hand-wavy bullshit for narrative purposes. But then there's also the Darmok and Jalad episode with Captain Picard, and he plays a captain in The Wrath of Khan. I forget his name, but he's the police chief from Terminator, Lance Henriksen's buddy who gets shot in the police station. I'm sorry, I don't remember the actor's name, but he's a very distinguished actor. That's an episode where the alien speaks in parable. So even if you could understand the words he's saying, you don't have context, so you don't know what he means. Again, similar premise. And also, from a personal standpoint, I haven't heard this brought up very often in reference to this film, but this is a deep cut reference to a movie that I saw when I was pretty young. It's called Hell in the Pacific. Have you heard of this one, Kyle?
No.
As I said, deep cut. I don't hear people talk about this movie, but this is actually the movie that comes to my mind whenever I think of Enemy Mine. To me, it like feels like it, they borrowed the premise or something. Although Enemy Mine is based on a novel, by the way, that was written in the 70s. So it is an adaptation. Hell in the Pacific is a World War II movie about Lee Marvin and Toshiro Mifune being stranded on an island in the Pacific, a Japanese and American soldier during World War II. And again, they kind of have to lean on each other to survive on this island alone. A very, very similar premise. And in fact, this is a very common story that we see repeated throughout fiction constantly. So those are just a handful of references. Even fucking like Kong Skull Island kind of borrows that in the prologue where, what's his face from The Perfect Storm? A big forehead. I can't remember his name.
John C. Reilly?
There you go. He, in the prologue of that movie, gets stranded on Skull Island with a Japanese pilot. And they start out trying to murder each other, and then Kong shows up, and then it's implied that they formed a friendship after that to, you know, survive together. Very similar concepts. Anyway, you did mention the space battle. There's probably a reason you liked it. It's because it's done by ILM, Industrial Light and Magic, the same people who just a couple years before this had been working on Return of the Jedi and, you know, other Star Wars films. So this is old hat for them. They knew how to do this shit.
I would say ILM, it just sounds like a 70s prog rock band every time you mention them.
ELO, ILM, same difference.
Right there. It's right there. I was really excited when I saw the spaceships because it looks good. And you were right. You cannot fault this movie for not looking good. It looks fantastic every step of the way. It looks good. They really took the time and care for all the sets, even like the matte paintings, any kind of rear projection stuff that's going on, like it all looks really, really good. And Luke Gossett Jr.'s makeup looks really good. Is he actually 6'4"? I thought he was 5'9". Or even shorter.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised by 6'4". Maybe James Woods is real tall as well, because we very early episode of Catching Up on Cinema, we did Digstown, which is another movie I saw when I was young that I don't think Kyle was a huge fan of.
No, Lou Gossett Jr. is 0-for-2, man. Like,
I like him so much. He's a very talented actor, but if you were to point to like a performance of his that you would credit as like your favorite, do you have one? Because he's one of those guys who he's been acting forever, but it's actually kind of hard for me to like point to like big deal movies of his that I've actually seen.
Who, Lou Gossett Jr.?
Yeah.
Oh, this is the second movie I've seen with him.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I kind of have a similar relationship because I have seen An Officer and a Gentleman, which, as far as I recall, was the one that got him an Oscar, or at least a nomination. That was a really big deal movie for cinema, but also for him in particular. And then he did the Iron Eagle movies, which were kind of like 80s trash action movies. I've only seen a scattering of those. I'm not a dedicated fan of the Iron Eagle franchise. And he's also in the Dolph Lundgren Punisher movie in a very small role. But I've always liked him as a performer. He has a very distinct delivery and quality to the way in which he presents himself. Like, it's always apparent that it's him, even when he's covered in fucking reptile makeup. And Kyle's absolutely right. The makeup effects, to me, on an aesthetic level, I really like the way this movie looks. I have heard it said that it's sometimes perceived as being a little scattershot, like some effects are done better than others. I mean, I kind of agree, but on the whole, I think it's a very cohesive and handsome-looking movie in most regards. But in particular, on this most recent viewing, I was looking for seams. I was looking for flaws in Lou Gossett Jr.'s makeup, and they are hard to spot. It's a really well-done effect. Like, he disappears into this character. He is robbed of so many tools as an actor, but his ability to emote and convey character is not hindered in any way. And not only that, it's a really distinct image. Like, it's very unique in cinema. I can't really think of many aliens presented in this fashion. And by the way, the effects, the makeup for the creatures and for Lou Gossett Jr. were done by Chris Wallace, who I think I know mostly as working on Gremlins, but he also worked on, I believe, David Cronenberg's The Fly. So this is a very, very talented individual we're working with, but... Yeah, I really love the presentation of the Drac in this movie. Like, there's just so many intricate little details in there that really make him... You don't think of him as a human, but you do think of him as a person, if that makes sense. Just because his anatomy is so different. Like, in particular, I love his teeth and his gums. Mm. There's some reason that weird Drac smile that he has always makes me smile.
I wonder how uncomfortable it was, because I remember hearing, like, Jim Carrey had to, like, learn how to undergo, like, torture, basically, to get his makeup put on for the Grinch. I'm like, this looks like it's probably not comfortable, and he's got quite a bit of screen time in this movie. And like you said, like, he's able to actually emote, and actually, there's actually a character here, not just, like, a mask.
Yeah, no, I haven't actually heard any stories about his feelings on the makeup application process, but I do remember hearing that, like, I think Jim Carrey was practicing, like, transcendental, like, meditation or something to get through the Grinch, and that's not even including the mask. Like, the Grinch was a different thing altogether, as far as I know.
Well, I think from what I remember hearing from the Grinch was that he had to learn how to... He learned, like, withstanding torture techniques from, like, CIA, like, former CIA folks, because it was that bad. I'm like, guys, I mean, it was worth it. He made, like, $30 million or $25 million doing that movie. So it was worth it.
Yeah, movies that broke actors. You can slot the Grinch into that slot. It's like it damaged him on a psychological level.
I'm doing my Phil Hartman as Frank Sinatra playing the fiddle.
Hey, laughing all the way to the bank.
I think that's it.
Let me ask you this. Did you get to the kid?
Yeah, that's where I'm like, okay, we're good. We're good now. Yeah, he gives birth. That was so fucking weird. Like, him being pregnant, it was so goofy. I understand. They said at the beginning, they both have male and female organs, and I guess they produce asexually. But it's just so weird. He's just like, I don't know if it's super cold. He does look kind of reptilian, Drac does. And it seems like he's probably cold-blooded, like he needs to stay near warmth out there. I didn't catch it, but I just kind of assumed. And Dennis Quaid like comes back, and he's just like, I'm out there looking for shit. And he's got his, you know, long hair and his beard. And Drax is just like, I'm pregnant. And it's like, and he's like super excited for him, too. I'm like, guys, this is a burden. Like, you can barely feed yourselves.
That scene is very odd. In particular, Dennis Quaid's reaction to it is like Kyle had said, really hyperbolic and outsized. Like, he's just like, he's so amused. But then again, I guess you have to remember that it's like they're going stir crazy. So it's like when you have things to laugh about, like, probably on some level, you probably just dial it up to 11 just because you have stimuli. Like, you have something happening for a change. Mm-hmm. I actually really like that aspect of the movie. Like, I like the way the passage of time is conveyed, where when they first meet each other, they don't speak a common language. So, like, Dennis Quaid has to, like, mime all of his attempts to communicate. And I like that they start to learn each other's language. But on top of that, you have, like, those scenes where they go off on each other. Like, they get cabin fever, and they start to get violent with each other, and like they even start to throw their prejudices, they boil back to the surface because these two races are at war. And it's strongly implied that like the Drac might be fairly innocent in this conflict. Like Jerry the Drac seems to strongly believe that his people are explorers, not conquerors. Whereas Dennis Quaid makes no bones about the fact that it's like, no, we go places, we plant the flag. America, space America.
Well, every administration has their propaganda machine. So I think other cultures have got that too, other planets.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's never, no finger is ever pointed more heavily than the other. They do a very good job of balancing that. But I really like the scene when the Zerki, the meteorites are cascading down on them. Mm-hmm. Because that's the whole reason for these two characters teaming up in the first place. Is like initially, Dennis Quaid wants to straight up murder Jerry the Drac. Mm-hmm. Because Jerry shot down one of his friends. His co-pilot died during his crash. He wants vengeance on Jerry the Drac. And they do actually say in narration that he's never actually seen a Drac face to face. Which is, I guess, that's part of the, like, the through line of the story, is that through exposure, through this process of learning other cultures, like, this is how prejudices can be attacked and somewhat softened. But I like that the environment is hostile to both of them. Like, I like how they convey, like, the flora and fauna of the planet. Like, they have the turtle slugs. Mm-hmm. And the Sarlacc pit. Kyle's nodding with satisfaction. Yeah. I do like that there's a Sarlacc pit in the movie that eats the turtle slugs. And then through visual language of film, we learn that the turtle slugs apparently evolved to survive meteorite storms that hit the planet's surface periodically, like any rainstorm on our planet. So they like build a shelter out of the turtle slug shells and stuff. But there's that scene where they're both taking shelter, and like there's a meteorite storm going on. Their house is being bombarded. They're shouting at each other. They start to wrestle. Dennis Quaid tries to choke Jerry to death. But eventually he, you know, as soon as the storm stops, he comes to his senses and he stops. But I don't often give positive credit to Dennis Quaid for his acting ability, but I did like the sequence where he's laying on his side like the xenomorph at the end of Alien. Mm-hmm. When it's doing its weird alien shit in the bunk on the escape pod of the Nostromo. Mm-hmm. Like similar posture is what I'm saying. Weird reference, but that's what I saw. Anyway, he's just like looking through Jerry, and his tone is haunted. Like you can tell he's losing his fucking mind, and he's actually verbalizing that. He's like, we gotta do something, Jerry, otherwise I'm gonna kill you or you're gonna kill me. Everybody's gonna die unless we do something. And I actually liked that they let that scene breathe and like let him do some of that acting shit, because he actually delivered. And as I said, it's not common for me to praise Dennis Quaid as an actor, but I thought he did something with that.
This might be his best performance, honestly. Like, it's not, it's over the top. Like, he's kind of, it's what's needed in this movie, basically. But he's not like, he's not phoning it in. Like, he's committed to this character, and it's silly at times, but I appreciate that he did it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that point of this is what the movie needed, because you really are just kind of stuck with two characters for most of the time, and oftentimes it's just him. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you may as well go a little bit big with it again, and you also get to hand wave that away by the fact that he's isolated. He's going a little bit nuts. So if to him, having hyperbolic reactions isn't strange.
Frequency. That's another one. I completely forgot about frequency.
I think I put that on the list too. I don't think that's a brilliant film, but I do remember seeing it exactly one time, and I think the end of it was the reason why I wanted to talk about it, just because it's so bonkers. Yeah, just that part where the dude's hand disappears. I just remember that part.
Jim Caviezel, is that his name?
Yeah, Jesus. Yeah, anyway, Jim Caviezel and Dennis Quaid. both people that I don't have the best of things to say about.
Yeah.
It's a common thing on Catching Up on Cinema. Monsters of Cinema.
Jim Caviezel, he is from Washington. I didn't realize that.
I didn't know that. Holy shit.
Yeah.
Wow.
He's yours.
Yeah, we disowned him. Hey. I know you were just visiting, but like, but we Washingtonians, we disown him. He's, especially his more recent filmography. That in Western Washington, that shit don't fly. Can't speak for the other parts. Anyway.
Yeah.
Brian James. Did you get to see Brian James, Kyle?
I saw his face, but I didn't get to see where he comes into the film, unfortunately.
Okay, well, he is relegated to just the last act in the movie. And I did mention the kid. Zamis is the kid's name. He is played by Bumper Robinson, who is not a household name, does not have a dense filmography, but as a television actor and a voice actor, this guy's got some holy shit level credits. He is a working fucking actor. Done a lot of superhero cartoons and such. He's almost like the go-to when it comes to voicing the character of Cyborg from any DC Comics related animation projects or games for that matter. If you've seen cartoons in the past 20, 30 years, you've probably heard this guy's voice at some point, is what I'm saying. He's a hardworking actor. Not a household name, though. I thought he did a really good job as a little kid. Like, this is a little kid wearing heavy makeup appliance, and yet he's very similar to Lou Gossett Jr. Like, one, he's able to match a lot of the quirks to, like, the language quirks and, like, the physical quirks that Lou Gossett Jr. brought to his performance. So I'm guessing the two of them spent a lot of time mimicking each other, you know? And on top of that, he conveys a lot of emotion. There's an interesting little story going on here where his dad passed away in giving birth to him. And I do say dad because, as far as I understand, like, I mean, as Kyle had said, they reproduce asexually, but there is a funny part where Dennis Quaid refers to Lou Gossett Jr. as a woman, and he, like, shoots him a look, and he's like, I am not a woman. It's like, whoa, okay, you've made your choice. Yeah. It's like, check, I understand. So I use the word dad, not out of disrespect, but out of respect for the man's wishes.
Well, it's nice to see that fragile masculinity made it into their culture as well.
It was the 80s, man. But yeah, the kid has this whole thing where he's like, so I'm being raised by someone who doesn't look anything like me, and they have this visual symbol of their hands, where the Drac only have three fingers, and humans obviously have four fingers and a thumb. And he's like, why is that? He's like, well, we're different things. Like, your father is a Drac, and it's my responsibility to honor your father and teach you the Drac culture and such. And the Drac culture involves a lot of faith, and is a very lineage-based culture. Like, they have this thing where they sing their lineage, and it's like 100 generations or something. So it's a very long process that involves a lot of diligence. And they have like a little book that may as well be like a Quran or something, that it's in the Drac language, and they read parables and phrasings from it that have a lot of parallels to like Christianity or Islam, earthly religions, I guess. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Brian James shows up, and he is the catalyst for the slam bang action thriller finale of the movie, which is largely unwarranted. But it's like one of those things that I'm guessing a producer got squirrely and decided we need something. We need some sort of fireworks at the end of this movie. And one thing that is important to note is that Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom came out in 1984. This film came out in 1985. I don't know the scheduling of the shooting or the scripting of the finale of Enemy Mine, but the similarities are numerous. it's a big shootout slash fist fight in a fucking mine. There's Drax being held as slaves, which may as well be child laborers, like in Temple of Doom. It has a really similar vibe, is what I'm getting at. But all things considered, it's not the worst action finale to a movie. It just kind of comes out of fucking nowhere. And then on top of that, there's a whole thing where Dennis Quaid gets shot and you think he's dead, but then he's not. And they take, like, he magically gets saved and resuscitated. It almost, the pace of it almost feels like a dream sequence. Like, it feels like he's dying and this is what he's imagining. Like, it feels like, I'm not going to name drop what movie it feels like, because somebody out there maybe hasn't seen it and doesn't want to have it spoiled for them, but it feels like somebody imagining how they'd like this to go down rather than how it actually went down, if that makes sense. But yeah, Dennis Quaid comes back to the planet and he's here to save zombies, and Brian James is here to be Brian James. So, Kyle, other than Blade Runner, do you have any connection to Brian James?
I very much do. He is the lieutenant from The Fifth Element. Did you check your messages? Might be something important.
I love that bit. Yeah, he's very funny in that. Like, Brian James is traditionally like a heavy, but in The Fifth Element, he's not. He is there purely for comedy.
Yeah. He looks remarkably like a friend of mine. I'll have to show you. Well, especially him in the beginning of Blade Runner. I have a friend who looks just like him in Blade Runner.
Oh shit. Yeah. I always thought that the guy in the Thomas Jane Punisher who gets it the worst out of everybody kind of looks like him. Yeah, Kyle's doing the knife under the chin.
That's so good. I love that.
Kyle gets it. Yeah. Yeah, he gets his arm twisted out of place. He gets a knife in the palm. He gets his foot shoot off, and that's kind of amazing though, because it's like, yeah, that even a tough guy makes that noise when all that happens to them. Yeah. It doesn't matter at that point. But yeah, he gets the knife. I think it's through the chin, through the tongue, and presumably through the palate and into the brain. Otherwise, I don't know how that would be a fatal blow unless he penetrated the base of the skull and went into the brain. But it is... I actually wrote an article about that scene, Kyle.
Did you?
Yeah, I wrote an article about it for a blog that I was doing when I was unemployed, where I was looking for work, and I made it a daily project to just do some writing. And I was doing articles about overkill in cinema, like... instances. There's a famous moment from The Simpsons where I think it's Homer beating up the Krusty Burger equivalent of the Hamburglar, and a bunch of kids are watching this happen, and this kid goes, "Oh, stop, stop, he's already dead." to quote another Simpsons episode, "He'll kill you five times before you hit the ground." Instances of that in cinema. I always think that's really funny, where it's like, dude, that guy's been dead for a while. Like, why are we still killing him? So I did that. I did Guyver 2. And I did March for Death, which I think we talked about just, like, last week. And yeah, The Punisher from 2004. That sequence landed an article as well on my blog. But yeah, Brian James, I would love to see that photo of your friend, by the way, the one who looks like Brian James. Traditionally, he is a heavy in cinema, but he's also a very versatile actor. As Kyle had mentioned in The Fifth Element, he's very funny, just kind of like effortlessly funny in that, but kind of similar to the kid who played Zombies in this movie. Brian James also has a very dense filmography as a voice actor. Most notably to me, he plays Parasite on the Superman cartoon. Did you and Nick ever watch the Superman animated series?
No.
Kyle shaking his head, no. just Batman, no Superman?
Yeah, no, we were not a Superman household.
Okay, well, I like that cartoon for what it's worth. I'm not the biggest fan of Superman, but that's a cartoon from the same animation team as the animated series of Batman. They, in fact, did a crossover for a while there. But yeah, Brian James plays Parasite, and I thought he brings a really fun energy to it, where he's very like streetwise and casual, even though he's like a supervillain. Where it's like, wow, you're like super crazy strong, but like you just sound like every guy I would meet on the street. it's an interesting way to convey that character. I liked it a lot. But yeah, he's big, ugly, bad guy at the end of the movie that I'm guessing producers felt this movie needed. And he gets it real bad. This movie gets really violent at times, Kyle. Did you notice that?
Mm-mm. I didn't watch the last 30 minutes, so I didn't see any violence.
Even prior to that, when the Sarlacc beast is attacking Dennis Quaid and it wraps its tentacle tongue thing around his leg. That's gnarly.
I thought it was just the tentacle. I was like, is that blood? I'm like, that's a lot of blood. I'm like, but is that, I thought it was just his tentacle. I thought his tentacle was just red and there was like saliva or something coming off. I didn't realize.
No, that's okay. Blood. Yeah, he's a fucking bloody mess after that. It's kind of amazing he like survived that, if I'm being honest. Because his leg almost gets yanked off. And then prior to that, there's like the space battle stuff, and like during the crash when his co-pilot Dak gets killed, he's pretty fucked up too when he pulls him out of the ship.
His co-pilot Dak?
His co-pilot Dak.
His co-pilot Dak. Huh.
His co-pilot Dak.
Interesting.
His name isn't Dak, Kyle. I'm just making a reference.
But his name is like Jack. Doing. It's like you weren't far off. I think his name is Jack. I'm like, I thought it was Jack.
Oh, fuck. You mean Dak?
Jack?
Remember, Empire Strikes Back didn't come out that long before this, and some of the same effects people worked on this. So, you know, maybe. Nah, I mean, even the fact that they have the cockpit shots the way they're set up, and the fact that there is somebody in a rear chair behind them, mm-hmm. is kind of an odd choice. The production design of the interior of the starships is a little funky, or it's too roomy. You know, it's like the cockpit, like the pilot's seat of like the Star Wars fighters and stuff. You're crammed in there, like there's no wiggle room or something. It's like airtight. You're like locked into it. But this, it's like it's spacious. Like you got elbow room and stuff. Like you can be doing windmills and stuff in between. Dogfights in space and stuff, and then like the co-pilot is like seated sideways, so it looks like they're in like an AWACS or something, but it's like it's a fighter. It's a weird choice. Like the production design is neat, but it is intentionally dated. It's kind of strange that this is a 1980s sci-fi movie based on a novel written in the 70s, but the production design, like the aesthetic that kind of went with, almost has like a 1950s vibe to it. It's odd, but I kind of like it. Like I like how the shape of the ships feels like a Flash Gordon serial or something. Like it doesn't have that like aerodynamic quality that like some of the Star Wars stuff would have had in the late 70s or the early 80s. I like it. Maybe it doesn't work for everybody. I thought it was neat. But yeah, I did say the movie does get violent from time to time. The whole finale is surprisingly brutal. Again, made me think of Temple of Doom, where a dude gets dropped into a rock grinder. And unlike Indiana Jones, we actually see the dude go into it. Like, we see him get squished. Like, it's not like cut away or like watch the guy get pulled into the rock grinder and then cut away. It's like, no, we see a dummy fall into the thing and he gets twisted. He gets deformed, is what I'm saying. There's an arrow that goes through the back of a dude's neck and out the front of his throat in gruesome detail. And Brian James gets fucking melted in molten metal. And not only does he fall into the pit, for some reason, we felt the need to include an additional shot of his, like, melting corpse lurching up out of it and then sinking. It's just, like, a couple of frames, but it's like, dude, I got kids, man. Like, did we need to see a melting skeleton? And it's like, yeah, you did. You did. But yeah, the whole end of the movie is... Davich, by the way, is the name of Dennis Quaid's character. He takes Amis to the Drac planet. He goes there as a human who is from a race of beings who is at war with the Drac, so somehow they let him make that voyage. And he takes them before, like, the Drac Council and recites Zamis's incredibly dense family lineage, basically like reciting a prayer of sorts, in front of, like, a big audience. And they embrace Zamis as part of their people, even though he wasn't raised by a Drac. And then on top of that, they add Dennis Quaid's name to that lineage. So it's, like, supposed to be, like, symbolic of, like, the end of Rocky IV. If I can change and you can change, everybody can change. It was in the air in 1985. But yeah, any other concluding thoughts about this one?
No, that's it.
All right, well, I will say I do find this movie charming. Oh, what?
You didn't technically pick this one. You narrowed it down, but I did choose it. So this is my fault.
It's your fault for being excited, too.
Yeah, it was my fault for being excited.
You stupid bitch.
You stupid bitch.
I find this movie charming. I've seen it many, many times. It's not a perfect movie by any means. Not one that I would strongly recommend to folks, but... I think it's neat. I mostly enjoy looking at it. The soundtrack is kind of spotty. It's Maurice Jarre, I believe is the name. Prolific composer, worked through many, many decades of film. Worked on fucking, like, Lawrence of Arabia, among other, like, grand epic classic films that I haven't seen because I'm too busy watching things like Enemy Mine and The Rock, you know, real cinema, and Undisputed 4, Boyka. the soundtrack is very up and down. It has some, like, flares of, like, John Williams-esque tonality to it. Sometimes it's, like, really grating and atonal. It's kind of a mixed bag. I do like the thrumming electronic piece that plays over the human space station at the beginning and the end of the movie. That was kind of neat. And some of, like, the grand sweeping orchestral tracks that play over, like, the Peter Jackson-esque traveling shots, like the helicopter shot kind of stuff, is neat too. I do think this movie's pretty funny at times. I don't think either of us put enough emphasis on how good Lou Gossett Jr. is in this movie. Like, I do think he delivers a remarkable performance that probably should be re-examined and talked about maybe a bit more, because I know An Officer and a Gentleman is, like, the big one on his filmography, but considering what he's working with, he really stepped the fuck up. And I like the presentation of the Drac culture. And some of the stuff he does in it just makes me laugh. Like, I like when he's learning English and he sounds like a little kid. And he's like, this is my head, and that is you head. You ugly head. And then he goes, like, that's how he laughs. He's, like, so amused by his discovery of humor in a foreign language. It's very charming. Anyway, I've said more than enough about this one. This wasn't a deep dive discussion, but I think we got something out of it. I think we talked about The Punisher with more passion than this one. But hey, that's a movie for a different day as well, because we already did Punisher Warzone. Better movie, Kyle?
Oh, yes. This is so much better.
I'm speaking in reference to the Thomas Jane one.
Thomas Jane Punisher being better than this movie?
Or Punisher Warzone being better than Thomas Jane Punisher?
Warzone is definitely better than Thomas Jane Punisher. without
a doubt. You heard it here, folks.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we'll tackle that one someday, or maybe I can convince you to watch the Dolph Lundgren one.
I have to do it for the podcast. I won't watch it on my own.
Never. Never. But yeah, this was Enemy Mine from 1985, directed by Wolfgang Petersen. As I said before, Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays, given this will have been posted just after Christmas. But yeah, if you'd like to catch up on any of our other Catching Up on Cinema content, you can find all of that collected on our website at catchinguponcinema.com. You can also find us on the social medias in the form of, I think it's official now, and I kind of hate it, X at Catching Cinema. Used to be Twitter, formerly Twitter, as well as the Instagram at Catching Up on Cinema. So feel free to hit me up at either of those. And the podcast is available on pretty much every platform you can imagine, including Bitcade. So fucking Google it.
Google it.
And that being said, thank you so much for listening, and we will catch you next time.